Luther Commons, where truth and news still exist in the original form. This is TNT Radio, news from the blogs. 45 minutes of news that has not passed through the propaganda machine we know as the mainstream media. We're brought to you this evening by Blogin Broadcasting Service. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your Wednesday net reporter. If you have a question or something to report, call us toll-free at 1-888-268-4313 or call direct at 530-876-3222. And if you want airtime to present your own views, your ideas, your innermost emotions, you can give us a call. Now, our program tonight is going to be a little bit different than the one that I shared with you last week. This time, I'm going to take you through a short tour of the blogosphere, sharing with you some insights on some of the best sites that I personally go to for my information. But first, I'm going to share something else with you that is pretty personal for me, and that is my most recent blog. And my blog is available at How the Neocons Stole Freedom, all run together, .blogspot.com. And this one is titled, The Shots Heard Round the World Were Not a Government Operation. As the harsh storms of winter subside, we approach the 231st anniversary of an event in American history that can provide insight and direction badly needed today. On April 19th, 1775, the shot heard round the world marked a clash of arms over a small bridge standing astride the stream at Concord, Massachusetts. We've all seen the statues, and some of us have heard the poetic paeans to the event that took place there. To this day, no one knows who fired that shot, but the unfolding clashes shocked the British crown and set the stage for the first nation on earth who proclaimed the principle of universal freedom in July of the next year. This was not a government operation. Perhaps the best lesson to be drawn from those events, which we have allowed to be obscured through the misted lens of time, is that this marked a moment when the people did it themselves, and in so doing confounded the greatest power then existing on earth, a power comparable to our government today. The colonists standing at Lexington and Concord were routed. They had been standing in battle formation, as soldiers did back then. After that initial few rounds of fire, they rejected the conventional approach to war and took to the woods, spontaneously conducting a guerrilla action as the Redcoats marched back to Boston. This example of spontaneous order shows a strong bent for innovation and a rejection of strategies that fail. Software wonks today would understand completely. Now, that is a learning curve to applaud, but it's not the best part. The alarm that had gone out through the nighttime activities of Paul Revere and Dawes had been delivered. At that point in time, the British Empire had 8,000 men under arms across the globe. A far smaller number were serving the crown in New England. That, the crown felt, was entirely sufficient. At the end of that day, 10,000 Americans were marching toward Lexington and Concord, muskets, knives, and hammers in hand, prepared to kick some redcoat butt. Women who saw off husbands, fathers, brothers, and sons, prepared to keep the home fires burning, and everyone fed. Total mobilization included everyone. When the people decided to do something, it gets done. No government could have organized these events. They came straight from the minds and hearts of the people. The year before, the colonists had nearly been caught with their pants down when another expedition of the Crown had narrowly been thwarted in its plan to confiscate the munitions being gathered in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. War was coming. The Crown had cut off their supply of munitions. After the capture of Fort William and Mary in Portsmouth, the colonists were determined to be prepared. The months leading up to April 19th and the bridge had been filled with preparations that included not only ensuring that an early warning system was in place, Revere and Dawes among others, but that the crusty colonists understood the issues. Committees of correspondence comprised of people from every town had been discussing the causes for the conflict and what we would think today as the mission statement for what would be America. They had built agreement through persuasion and discourse. No one voted for war. When the broadsides came out from Philadelphia bearing the words of the Declaration of Independence that next year, this population knew what they meant. This was an amateur operation from the beginning. They had few resources, limited munitions, and no central organizing structure. That is doubtless why it worked. They had to be inventive and be prepared to acquire expertise they lacked. The year after the declaration was signed, July 4th, 1776, they had cobbled together an army of the same people, but their lack of experienced generals made those first months of action a disaster. George Washington looked like a general, but he had no substantial training in the strategies and practicalities of war. Fortunately, he also knew how to innovate and was modest enough to see the need. That long, nasty winter at Valley Forge was not what you think it was. Men were not dying of disease and creeping away. They were having an intense round of training exercises that included training Washington to lead the troops. The trainer was Baron von Steuben, an officer with Prussian General Staff training. Soldiers who went through those winter months in Valley Forge tended to end up officers themselves. I went into the DAR on Benjamin Pillsbury, who went through training at Camp Valley Forge and was commissioned a lieutenant. There were no bureaucrats, and it all worked fine. America is not a nation like other nations. The vision that gave the colonists the motivation to throw off the chains of the British Crown were both spiritual and civil, evoking that mission statement from Thomas Jefferson penned in the Declaration of Independence that coalesced support. They were all investing their lives, fortunes, and sacred honors, not just the ones who signed. Unlike the early Greek and Roman writers who had applied the concepts of democracy and rights to define what was actually an oligarchy, where only a tiny minority of people exercised power, the American vision proclaimed that each of us possessed that same inherent nature, which included the right of autonomy before the existence of government of any kind. Government was, in that view, a service center, providing only those services that the people could not provide for themselves. The colonists were practical people who would never have paid for the padded privileges assumed by later generations of government officials. It was a Yellow Pages approach to government, and if today government was limited to what we can't find either in the local Yellow Pages or do locally through charity, there would be legions of bureaucrats looking for jobs at McDonald's. That's a satisfying image. You might sit down and make out a list of essential services and leaf through your local Yellow Pages sometime. If the service is there and you need it, then government should not be involved according to the original game plan. Even two generations ago, government spent most of the money it takes from us on its own infrastructure while creating an attractive nuisance by dangling unearned wealth in the eyes of the least ethical. A seat in Congress can, in less than 10 years, turn a down-at-the-heels political science student into a multimillionaire. And these ethically challenged individuals are not being paid off for their good looks. Unfortunately, those immediately following the revolution believed they needed a government, something like those with which we are familiar in Europe. That was a mistake, and today the bill for that mistake, and others, accounted for in the compound interest of 12 generations of power gone amok, is demanding to be paid. I know that the veterans of the capture of Fort William and Mary would have thought. I know what those 20,000 early Americans would have said as preparations continued on the home front while the men marched off to war carrying their own muskets. Fire would have become fire them. It is local organizing and innovation that does the job every time. Most of us who are involved in local charities understand that the needs of those living on the edge of poverty are rising rapidly as mega corporations and government, those long time bedfellows, continue to eat us alive. This is not due to sloth or laziness on the part of those in need. The real needy in America could each be millionaires on what we spend on government. Any of us could find ourselves in the position of facing circumstances we could never have anticipated. The reasons are many. The effect is to place a heavier burden on those within the community who are the last line of defense against hunger, cold, and death. After several generations, when Americans have assumed that these safety nets were being handled by the morass of government agencies, certainly well-funded for the purposes, the real relief of need remains in the hands of local activists working as volunteers. This is true in Santa Barbara, where Unity House feeds and trains more needy for less than the multitude of agencies heavily funded by government. It's true in small towns across the country and in urban areas. It's most probably true where you live, too. Americans are used to getting the job done, whether that job is feeding the hungry, searching for missing campers, or ensuring their own freedom. Ultimately, that is how this present encounter with a state gone amok will be resolved. You can almost hear the voices of those early Americans cussing about the waste and pomposity of the government that confronts us today. It's time to reboot America's government. The people can do it themselves. Get off the grids. Organize locally. Build coalition. It is time to finish the revolution. Well, you can't say that I don't have a particular viewpoint, and I really, really enjoy sharing it with you here. But the blogosphere includes positions from every point of the political spectrum, and it also includes some things that we need to warn you about. There are a lot of places up there where you're going to go when you're going to read pieces that have been carefully manufactured and put together to lie. There are websites where people do that intentionally. And one of the things that you should do when you're surfing the web and you're looking for yourself is to make sure that you check your sources. Take a look at the people who are writing it. If you're taking a look at an organization, make sure that there are actually people's names there. Check it out. And now I'm going to share with you three of the websites that I have found the most useful on the web, websites that I look at, and I know that the people who are putting it up there have a particular set of ethics, a particular set of values in the way that they look at the web and the way they look at the truth. And the first one I'm going to share is LouRockwell.com. Now, Lou Rockwell is the president of the Mises Institute, and the Mises Institute is dedicated to the legacy of Ludwig von Mises, who's an Austrian economist of international fame and well-deserved. The blog that I'm going to read you is written by Anthony Gregory, and it's titled The Evil War on Drugs. Speak out too loudly against the drug war, and you might be targeted. Peter McWilliams had AIDS and cancer and was dependent on marijuana to stay alive. It turns out that the people who had been using the stuff medicinally for thousands of years were onto something. No one has ever been recorded as dying from the physiological effects of marijuana, but the federal government wouldn't let McWilliams, a vocal anti-prohibition activist, have his medicine. They threatened to take his mother's house away if he used the substance that was keeping him alive. He was found dead in his home, June 2000. The drug war killed him directly. And now Steve Covey is in jail, being deprived of the medical marijuana that has kept him alive. About a quarter century ago, he was diagnosed with an exceedingly rare strain of adrenal cancer that no one else had been able to survive for more than 5 years. He was expected to die within the same time frame. His physician, Dr. Vincent DiQuattro, an expert on this rare condition, has credited marijuana with saving his life. Several years ago, Covey was forcibly deprived of his medicine for 3 days in jail, during which he suffered extreme vomiting and shivering and went temporarily blind in one eye. In U.S. custody again, after having taken refuge in Canada and being extradited back to the land of the free, he now has a good chance of dying, of being murdered by the state, all so it can make an example of this courageous anti-drug war activist. For Covey, as was the case for McWilliams, prohibition for life-saving medicine could prove a cruel and unusual execution, all for the non-crime of self-medication, the right to which all humans are born. Apparently, he has been allowed to use some Marinol, but the synthetic THC simply isn't a replacement for the complex mixture of cannabinoids in marijuana. Smoking about 12 grams of pot a day has worked for him, allowing him to live a healthy life. The government's approved version does not quite do the trick, though it might barely be keeping death away. It is very uncertain at this point, and what will come of his health and legal situation. The drug war is misdirected. It is foolish. It is stupid, unworkable, disastrous, tragic, and sad. But above all of that, it is evil. The drug war is grounded in an evil premise, that people do not own their bodies, that they have no right to control what they do with their own lives and their own property, that it is appropriate to lock them in cages if they produce, distribute, or consume chemicals in defiance of the state. This is a monstrosity. As long as America has the drug war, it is not a free country. Politicians who support it and expand it, knowing the evil it entails, have no business lecturing us on morality. The ideology of the war on drugs is the ideology of totalitarianism, of communism, of fascism, and of slavery. In practice, it has made an utter mockery of the rule of law and the often spouted idea that America is the freest country on earth. The United States has one of the highest per capita prison populations in the world, second only to Rwanda, thanks largely to the drug war. All while its federal government imposes its drug policies on other countries by methods ranging from mere diplomatic bullying to spraying foreign crops with lethal poison, from bribing foreign heads of state to bankrolling and whitewashing acts of mass murder conducted by despots in the name of fighting drugs. Like so many other wars, the drug war is constructed on a mountain of lies. Politicians have lied over and over about the dangers of specific drugs, the percentages of drug offenders in prison, the success of various anti-drug programs, and the motives they have for waging the war. But even if it weren't for these acts of brazen dishonesty, the drug war would still be evil. The war on drugs is murderous. Militarized police forces frequently raid homes and assault or even slaughter innocent people, some of whom did not even break the unjust drug laws. And those laws are just that, unjust. Remember it always. The war on drugs is an unjust war of aggression. Its agents are in the wrong. Under the current system, if you defend yourself against this homegrown war of aggression, you may be killed instantly or put on death row like Corey May. The authorities will get away with it. The war on drugs is not a program that should be reconsidered, reformed, or reinvented. It needs not a different set of priorities or a restructuring. It needs to be repealed completely. Its prisoners need to be released without an instant of hesitation. Its greatest victims should be compensated as much as possible out of the pockets of the aggressors. Those at the top of this war must be held responsible for their illegal and immoral acts. I sometimes told that libertarians are too obsessed with the war on drugs. I disagree. I think the people in general, including many libertarians, should be more concerned with it. We're talking about the longest war in American history, one that has hundreds of thousands of innocent people locked in cages. Many of them are raped and beaten by convicted brutes, as the prison guards laughed, all at an exorbitant cost in tax dollars and liberty. We're talking about a program that has decimated every article in the Bill of Rights. We're talking about a modern-day witch trial and Inquisition, all wrapped up into one, and multiplied in its evil effects and destructiveness many times over. We're talking about a precedent for so many other evil policies, from prohibitions on so-called money laundering and the criminal enterprise known as asset forfeiture, to the egregious civil liberties violations conducted today under the guise of combating terrorism. They often say that all they want in the war on terror are the tools they've been using in the drug war for years. There's some truth to this, but they should never have had such sweeping powers to begin with, not for investigating crime, not for fighting terrorism, and especially not for a war on victimless activity. The practical complaints against the drug war have been repeated ad nauseum. Black market violence escalates, more people die of drug impurities, and so on. These are compelling enough to end the whole crusade, but the most fundamental reason to end it is that it's evil, very evil. It treats sick people like criminals. It wrecks millions of lives. It puts young people in jail, sometimes for a lifetime, only for engaging in activities that some of our presidents engaged in when they themselves were young. It criminalizes speech between doctors and patients and producers and consumers. It starts war in other countries. It is one of the greatest social evils in America. Unfortunately, a distinct political class profits immensely off the oppressive program, and has succeeded in bamboozling the public into thinking the program is a necessary evil or even a positive good. Several years ago, drug warriors mistook some missionaries flying to Peru for a plane of drug dealers and shot them down. Lou Rockwell asked, "Isn't it time the Christian right began to rethink the drug war, which has now taken two of their own?" Sadly, most of the Christian right, as well as most of the rest of the right, and all too much of the left, still believes in the evil drug war. They're afraid of what will happen if drugs are made legal. Well, will more people do drugs? Maybe. I don't personally think the long-term increase would be so dramatic. If there were one at all, at various times, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, LSD, ecstasy, amphetamines were illegal. The problems associated with legal drugs many years ago still exist today. But at least we didn't also have a deeply immoral war on drugs tearing society apart. even if some problems did increase, the drug war simply cannot be justified. It is rotten and immoral to the core. To put someone in a cage or to kill someone for engaging in private behavior or mutually voluntary trade is purely evil. That is the first and most important argument against the war on drugs. LouRockwell.com, you will find, will present you with blogs that touch on an enormous range of issues. Lou also makes it a point to make sure that he puts things up there that simply extend your vision and give you some things to think about and talk about. Some of these will include very interesting items on archaeology, anthropology, developments in different fields like neurobiology. Because one of the things that you get out of the blogging when you get in there and you start reading and you start thinking is you get the extension of mind that makes you most alive and makes the world such a wonderful place to be. And that's the first, that's the Lou Rockwell blog that I want you to go. You can go there and sign up. It's LouRockwell.com. Sign up and you every day in your mailbox, you will find a marvelous list of articles that will tempt, incite, and delight you to think about things that may have passed your notice otherwise. Our next piece is by Jacob Hornberger. Now, Jacob is the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. And this particular piece is called The Conservative Reform Game. Now, maybe it seems like we're picking on conservatives here since the last piece sort of touched on conservatives, but I don't think so. I think that these are very interesting think pieces, and I want you to think about it. Here we go again, the reform game. In the wake of the federal government's disastrous response to Hurricane Katrina, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff is unveiling reforms that will ensure that such federal disasters never happen again. Yawn. Just more standard conservative reform claptrap. This is par for the course conservatism. Engage in the never-ending game of criticizing federal paternalistic programs for being inefficient or for having waste, fraud, and abuse. And then calling for reform, always in the perpetual but futile quest to make such programs succeed. Another example of the standard conservative reform nonsense is a recent op-ed titled The Junkets You Fund by noted conservative columnist Michelle Malkin, which appeared in the conservative newspaper The Washington Times. In her article, Malkin detailed millions of dollars of taxpayer-funded waste, fraud, and abuse in federal junkets, those nice spring break-type trips, as Malkin calls them, that congressmen and federal bureaucrats take at U.S. taxpayer expense. Guess what Malkin suggested needed to be done to solve the problem? You got it. Reform. Just cut out the waste, fraud, and abuse from these federal junkets. Why Milken even shows us where to start. Yawn. Just more standard conservative reform claptrap. Conservative think tanks love the reform game, too, because they know that by calling only for reform rather than elimination of government paternalism, a steady and perpetual stream of donor money is guaranteed to flow into the organization. Donor-funded studies and then calls for reform. And then again, more donor-funded studies and more calls for reform. The game is never-ending because the paternalistic program never goes out of existence and therefore is always subject to being reformed, no matter how many times it has been reformed in the past. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, if the paternalistic program were abolished, there would be no more need for studies or calls for reform, and therefore no more need for solicitation of donations to fund more studies and more calls for reform. And so donations continue to stream in to conservative organizations from well-heeled conservative donors who hope to see the fulfillment of their lifelong dream before they die. Just one paternalistic federal program that has been reformed and doesn't have any more waste, fraud, and abuse. And that works. When it comes to reform of paternalistic programs, hope springs eternal within conservatives. It's also as if conservatives have a battered spouse syndrome relationship with the federal government, which might well be described as their daddy god, given the paternalistic, even godlike role that conservatives have relinquished to it. Oh, it's true that our federal daddy god has failed us once again with Hurricane Katrina, just as he failed us on 9/11, and just as he's failed us in Iraq. But we can't lose faith. Our daddy god loves us, means well, and takes care of us, especially with retirement, health care, education grants, subsidies, loans, and protections from terrorists. He'll be nicer, more responsible, more competent next time. We just have to keep worshiping and believing and reforming. Is it any wonder that conservatives get so upset when someone has the audacity to criticize the federal government or its paternalistic programs, either at home or abroad? Why, in the mind of the conservatives, such criticism constitutes disrespect, even blasphemy. Their federal daddy god just needs a bit of reform, that's all. Government paternalism is one of the things, of course, that distinguishes libertarians from both conservatives and liberals. Unlike both conservatives and liberals, we libertarians don't worship the federal government, and we don't want it taking care of us. Unlike conservatives and liberals, libertarians believe that the federal government has no more business taking care of people who suffer natural disasters than it does taking care of people who are elderly, sick, poor, or terrified. Unlike conservatives and liberals, we libertarians believe in ourselves, in others, in freedom, and in the free market. That's why we have no interest in reforming paternalistic programs. We just want to end them, along with the thousands of departments and agencies that administer them and the ever-burdensome taxes that fund them. Now, you'll notice that the last two pieces I read, actually, the three pieces I read, have a strong libertarian bent, and there's a reason for this. I used to be a libertarian before I re-registered something else. Lou Rockwell, when he was in politics, was briefly a libertarian, and Jacob Hornberger has been a libertarian for a long time. Curiously enough, one of the things you'll notice as you read blogs, and this process has been going on for a while now, is that there's starting to be a convergence of opinion instead of a divergence of opinion. And I suggest that you go take a look at that and think about it. And this last piece that I'm going to share with you tonight is one of the reasons that you are perhaps starting to notice that people are taking a look at what they thought and considering what they were using as sort of philosophical tool sets and deciding that perhaps they better reconsider and take a look at a set of tools that sort of gets them off the government bandwagon. Now, this one was actually printed on prisonplanet.com. It's by Paul Joseph Watson, and the title is Halliburton Detention Camps for Political Subversives. This is the sort of thing that can make a blogger nervous. In another shining example of modern-day corporate fascism, it was announced recently the Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg, Brown, and Root have been awarded a $385 million contract by Homeland Security to construct detention and processing facilities in the event of a national emergency. The language of the preamble to the agreement veils the program with talk of temporary migrant holding centers, but it is made clear that the camps will also be used as the development of a plan to react to a national emergency. Makes you wonder what an emergency is. Discussions of federal concentration camps is no longer the rhetoric of paranoid internet conspiracy theorists. It is mainstream news. Under the enemy combatant designation, anyone at the behest of the U.S. government, even if they are a U.S. citizen, can be kidnapped and placed in an internment facility forever without trial. Joe Padilla, an American citizen, has spent 4 years in a Navy brig and is only now getting a trial. In 2002, FEMA sought bids from major real estate and engineering firms to construct giant internment facilities in the case of a chemical, biological, or nuclear attack or a natural disaster. Okanogan County Commissioner David Schwartz went public 3 years ago with his contention that his county was set to be a location for one of those camps. Alex Jones has attended numerous military urban warfare training drills across the U.S., where role players were used to simulate arresting American citizens and taking them to internment camps. When you go on this link, there's some really interesting pictures, I have to tell you. The move toward the database state in the U.S. and the U.K., where every offense is arrestable and DNA records of every suspect, even if later proved innocent, are permanently kept on record, is the only tool necessary to create a master list of subversives that would be subject to internment in a manufactured time of national emergency. The national ID card is also intended to be used for this purpose, just as the Nazis used early IBM computer punch card technology. Well, that's a surprise. In catalog lists of homosexuals, gypsies, and Jews before the roundups began. Section 44 of the Terrorism Act in Britain enables police to obtain name and address details of anyone they choose, whether they're acting suspiciously or not. Those details remain on a database forever. To date, 119,000 names of political activists have been taken, and this is a figure that will skyrocket once the post-77 figures are taken into account. At the height of the Iraq war protests, around 1 million people marched across the country. However, most of these people were taking part in a political protest for the first time and as a one-off. Even if we take a figure of half, 500,000 people being politically active in Britain, that means the government has already registered around a quarter of political activists in the UK. In truth, the number is probably above half, because they are not factoring in those already on M15 subversive lists and those listed after the 7/7 bombings, when the powers were used even more broadly. Currently in the U.S., a new provision in the Extended Patriot Act bill will allow Secret Service agents to arrest and jail protesters accused of breaching any security perimeter, even if the president or other protected official isn't present. The definition of free speech zones can be shifted around loosely, and this would open the floodgates for protesters to be grabbed and hauled away in any circumstance at the whim of the Secret Service. During the 2004 Republican National Committee protests, thousands of New Yorkers were arrested en masse in indiscriminate roundups and taken to Pier 57, a condemned asbestos-poisoned old bus depot where they were imprisoned without charge for up to 24 hours. The existence and development of internment camps are solely intended to be used to round up en masse and imprison political dissidents. Anyone who isn't prepared to lick government boots after a simulated tactical nuke or biological attack on a major U.S. or European city. now. That gives you pause for thought, doesn't it? If you blog, if you go to the web, you may remember that last week I read the article that I had written about Cyberstorm. And what Cyberstorm is an exercise that was done by our government to be able to identify and place people who have the audacity to speak on the web using their First Amendment rights so that they can create an atmosphere of protest and increase the awareness of the American people as to what is happening. That's a pretty scary thing, isn't it? Well, this evening we've shared three specific sites that I want to remind you about. There's Rockwell.com, and there you get some of everything. You're going to get incredible insights on economics that will open your eyes to some of the things that are actually happening with policy in the United States today. We've talked about the Future of Freedom Foundation. And that one is located actually in Virginia. And on there, what you're going to find is opinion pieces that awaken you to things that you might not have thought about in quite that way, but maybe you should. And on prisonplanet.com, you're going to find things like detention camps. You're going to find exposés. You're going to find information that you really should have within your knowledge base, because if you blog, if you use the internet the way that it's intended to be used, this is information that you really are probably going to need. This is surfing the web, talking about ideas, thinking about the world that we live in and the world that we want to live in. These are some of the things that make us Americans. These are some of the things that make us who we are, the conscious people that we are, and the more conscious people that we want to be. And I want to thank you very much for being with me tonight, for thinking about some of these ideas, and I invite you to call in and share your thoughts anytime you want to do that. And that is the message of the blog tonight, March 15, the Ides of March, 2006. We here at TNT News Radio thank you for being here. In the 45 minutes that we've been talking, we've touched on just a few of those developing trends, those thoughts now shaping the direction of human action. Every minute, every second, there's more coming from places familiar and unexpected, and as I find those, I'm going to bring them here to share with you. Here at Blog In Broadcasting Service in the Aether Commons, the truth and news still exist in the original form. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your Wednesday Net reporter, wishing you well. May the blog be with you.
I love you.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a bloginservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.